From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the great cabaret singer and pianist Bobby Short. He's been performing at the Café Carlyle in Manhattan since 1968. Last week, he announced he will retire from the Carlyle in 2005. Although Short is synonymous with elegance, he grew up in a working-class family, and as a child, he performed in roadhouses and toured the vaudeville circuit. We'll talk about his life and listen to his music. Also, TV critic David Bianculli just got back from watching 11 hours of television a day for 11 days straight. He was a judge at the Banff Television Festival. He'll tell us about the best TV shows in the world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The new U.S. ambassador to Iraq has arrived in Baghdad just hours after the departure of U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer. Bremer handed limited sovereignty to Iraq's interim government in a private ceremony 2 days ahead of schedule. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
It was a small ceremony, and it only took about 20 minutes. Ambassador Bremer read a letter transferring power from the U.S.-led administration of Iraq to the interim Iraqi government. He said he would leave Iraq confident in its future, and then he left, shortly after the ceremony, on a plane bound for Washington. At a later ceremony, Iraq's ministers were sworn in. The handover date was pushed up by 2 days, partially to throw off anyone planning attacks. White House officials say the transfer also came early because interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi felt that would help him crack down on terrorists. Alawi is expected to outline new security plans on Tuesday. He said the security of Iraq is now in Iraqi hands, and he said he looks forward to continued help from U.S. and other foreign forces. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
Iraqi officials said today that former leader Saddam Hussein will be transferred to the custody of the interim government in the next few days. U.S. military officials say Saddam will still be held under U.S. guard because Iraq has no secure place to detain him. The Supreme Court issued decisions on 3 major terrorism cases today. The cases examine whether President Bush has the authority to seize and imprison suspected terrorists during wartime. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
In 2 of the cases, the High Court ruled that the Bush administration has the right to arrest and hold suspected terrorists, but that the prisoners must be able to challenge that detention. The High Court said that hundreds of foreign nationals being held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, could use American courts to challenge their detentions. So, too, can Yasser Hamdi, the Louisiana-born man captured in Afghanistan. The justices left open which court or other review body might hear the cases and what the government would have to show in order to keep the prisoners in custody. In the 3rd suit, the justices declined to rule on the case of Jose Padilla, whom the government alleges was plotting to set off a radioactive bomb. Padilla must refile his lawsuit in a lower court. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush is attending a NATO summit meeting in Istanbul, where alliance leaders differed today over the extent of help they should provide to the new Iraqi government. NATO has pledged to help train Iraqi troops, but France and Germany say the mission shouldn't result in a large alliance presence in Iraq. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 14 points to close at 10,357 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 5 to 2019. This is NPR News. NASA says the 2 crew members on the International Space Station will make a second try at a risky spacewalk mission on Wednesday. The first spacewalk was cut short last week after mission control discovered that pressure was dropping too fast in the oxygen tank of astronaut Michael Fink. NASA engineers say the problem was caused by a faulty switch. They say Fink and his Russian partner, cosmonaut Gennady Padalka, will be able to use the suits again on Wednesday. The 2 crewmen are trying to repair a damaged switch on the outside of the station. Crews are battling a 23,000-acre wildfire in Arizona's Tonto National Forest. Firefighters are trying to protect structures that are threatened by the blaze. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ.
The so-called Willow Fire is burning in rough, steep terrain near the town of Payson, Arizona, about 90 miles northeast of the Phoenix metro area. The lay of the land is making it hard for the 500 people on 7 crews that have been dispatched to the fire to fight it. Resources are in short supply this summer, as the Forest Service grounded nearly 3 dozen air tankers due to safety concerns. Those tankers, which are used to drop water and fire retardant, are not likely to fly again this year. The fire was started by lightning late last week and grew more than 10,000 acres Sunday night. Smaller fires are burning in several southwest states, including New Mexico, California, and Utah. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Consumer spending grew strongly in May. The Commerce Department said consumer spending was up by 1%, its steepest rise in more than 2 years. It said part of the increase came because consumers were paying more for items such as food and energy. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. An era of cabaret is coming to a close. Recently, Bobby Short, the king of cabaret singers, announced that this would be his final year at the Café Carlyle, the elegant club that has been his home for part of nearly every year since 1968. But last week, he revised his decision and agreed to stay through 2005 to celebrate the Carlyle's 50th anniversary year. After this Wednesday's performance, he'll take a break and return in October. Bobby Short is synonymous with elegance and performs in a posh setting, but as we'll hear, he grew up in the working class and performed as a child on the vaudeville circuit. Short is beloved for his interpretations of the great songwriters like Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, the Gershwins, and Noel Coward. He has always included many of their lesser-known songs in his repertoire, but let's start with a familiar song recorded in 1973.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. Our love is here to stay.
Bobby Short, welcome to Fresh Air. You're retiring from the Carlyle. Why did you decide to leave after so many years?
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to be 80 years old in September.
Wow.
And I think
I didn't realize
that. Yes, indeed. I think it's time to stop and figure out what you want to do with your life, you know?
Have you ever been bored at the Carlyle and felt like, oh, God, been there, done that?
Well, not bored. I mean, but work is work. I learned that a long time ago. And sometimes, even though you love your work, and I love my work, there are moments when you'd simply rather be at home or someplace else.
Now, I just want to mention, your voice is a little raspy. Is that from singing?
I'll tell you
all
about
these years?
My voice this morning.
Yeah.
I don't sleep very well. So on the weekends, I sometimes treat myself to a sleeping pill. And the result is what you hear. I needn't sing till tomorrow night. So by that time, the pill will have all worn off, you see.
So you have to trade hoarseness for
sleep. I tell
you,
it's a very complicated business. You've got to figure out which button to push and which phone call to make, you know.
I want to quote something that you wrote in your first memoir, Black and White Baby. And that book starts, "I am a Negro who has never lived in the South, thank God, nor was I ever trapped in an urban ghetto. I grew up in Danville, Illinois, where my family always lived on a pleasant street in a pleasant neighborhood." Would you describe that neighborhood that you grew up in?
Well, in Danville at that time, there were two sections of town that allowed Negroes to buy or to rent property. and we lived in the North End. That was considered rather a snobbish end of town because the East End was where the Negroes first settled in Danville, and it was kind of run down. But we had a nice paved street, and about six blocks, I think, there were six square blocks where Negroes could buy or rent a house to live in. That's the way it was. That, of course, has all been broken down since. But in those days, the enclave was just those six square blocks. And it was a pleasant street, paved with brick, and lots of trees and front yards and backyards, and people saying, how do you do, as they walked down the sidewalk every day.
Now, what was the first piano that you played? Where was it?
It was called Walworth, W-A-L-W-R-T-H, and it sat in my mother's parlor.
So did you actually have, like, parlor songs where people would sit around the parlor and play and sing?
Well, yes, we sat around the parlor and sang songs all the time. Entertainment was quite different from what it is today, you know, and people entertained at home.
Did your mother have a Victrola?
Oh, yes, we had to have that. That was obligatory. A Victrola and lots of records, and she kept a very, very strict eye upon what kind of records we bought, too.
Like what?
We couldn't bring in... Yeah. Bessie Smith and Ethel Waters singing the blues.
Did you like that?
I didn't know the other part of Ethel Waters and Bessie Smith. I didn't know about Bessie Smith's records until I was, I suppose, 17 years old.
No, it's funny because you were playing in roadhouses by then. I mean,
yes, of course I was.
It's funny that you needed to be protected from Bessie Smith when you were kind of living that life yourself.
Absolutely, without even knowing it.
How old were you when you started performing in saloons and roadhouses?
I think in Danville I must have been 9 years old. And it was hard. It was very depression time. And every penny counted for a lot. And we had one thing going for us that was our pride, you know. So my mother, with gritted teeth, allowed me to go out with some young men who were friends. My mother knew their parents. And I would play the piano in the roadhouses with them and earn $3 or $4 on a Saturday night.
So is that why you were performing, because the family needed money?
I performed for two reasons, Terry. I performed mainly to please myself, because I was dying to perform in front of other people. And it had a practical side, too, because I earned $3 or $4. And that went very, very far with our household expenses.
What songs were you singing when you were performing at the age of 9 in bars?
Oh, popular songs of the day. I knew all the standards, like Nagasaki and Nobody's Sweetheart Now and Glad Rag Doll and all the popular ballads of the day, and, of course, all the Bing Crosby songs from movies.
I know your mother didn't approve of hard liquor. How did she feel about you performing in places where people
drank?
Well,
she's of two minds again, you see. It's like U.B. Blake's old story. He was used to play the piano as a very, very young kid in a brothel somewhere, and the news of it got around to his father. And his father asked him one day, and he said, yes, it's true, I'm playing in this brothel. And the father finally said, well, how much are they paying you? Because the mother was totally against it. But I think the bucks up front changed the father's mind considerably.
Now, did you get to see people behaving in extreme ways because they were drinking?
Oh, my God, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. I saw drunk people, of course, and I saw people on the dance floor making perfect fools of themselves.
Did you think adults are really crazy, or did you think alcohol makes people crazy?
Well, I knew that. There was drinking in our family. My mother loathed alcohol, never allowed it in the house, but she had a sister and brother who rather liked it. They would come to the house to visit, and I would see what it did to people. I don't know. I think I... looked askance at all this free behavior and so forth. It never occurred to me that to ever partake of it. I mean, I was just, an onlooker.
Did you ever drink?
Oh, of course I drank. I had the drink. We all drank because it was stylish. And I even smoked, you know. I had the whole accoutrement. I had the cigarette lighter, the holder, all of that stuff, which makes you feel very sophisticated when you're, you know, 20 years old.
Let's hear. Let's pause here and listen to one of your performances. I thought we could play one of your early performances from the mid 50s. How about the Cole Porter song "Dream Dancing," which is a beautiful song. Not many people do it. It's the kind of thing we look to you for, you know, to find the lesser-known songs by the great composers. Would you talk a little bit about this song or about Cole Porter? Did you know Cole Porter?
I knew Cole Porter, yes. And I think that song is from a film called You'll Never Get Rich, which starred Fred Astaire and Rita Hayworth.
And just tell us a little bit about meeting Cole Porter. Did you know him well?
Well, there are those who knew him much better. I met Cole Porter in a very formal situation. I was accompanying a young girl who was going to audition for the role of Bianca in the road company of Kiss Me, Kate. This was 1948. And Porter was there to hold the audition. And he had apparently seen me before performing in a small club in Los Angeles, and he addressed me in the familiar. He said, "Bobby, what do you sing from the show?" Of course, I was doing Too Darn Hot. He said, "Do it for me." So I did it for him. And years later, I came to New York and performed Too Darn Hot in a revival of Kiss Me, Kate with Kitty Carlisle.
Did he ever give you advice on performing his songs, or did he ever
criticize
you?
And he was always delighted that I played his songs. I think in that area, he was really quite a humble person and never missed the chance to cross the room and say thank you very much.
Okay, well, this is Bobby Short, recorded in 1957, performing Cole Porter's Dream Dancing, and Bobby Short is singing and at the piano.
When day is gone and night comes on, until the dawn, what do I do? I touch your hand and wander through slumberland, dream dancing with you. We glide between a sky serene and fields of green sparkling with dew. It's joy sublime whenever I spend my time dream dancing. Dancing. Oh, what a lucky windfall, touching you, clutching you all the night through. So say you love me, dear, and let me make my career dream dancing to paradise prancing. Dream dancing with you. Dream dancing. Oh, what a lucky windfall. Touching you, clutching.
Bobby Short singing Cole Porter's Dream Dancing, recorded in 1957. We'll talk more with Bobby Short after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the great cabaret singer and pianist, Bobby Short. Well, when we left off, we were talking about you being a child performing in saloons and roadhouses. Then you moved on to the vaudeville circuit. Who were some of the people you shared the bill with?
Well, I shared the bill with a number of wonderful band leaders, Fletcher Henderson, Don Redman, Bunny Berrigan, and a lot of interesting people who were called stars in those days. I worked with Chuck and Chuckles, and I worked with Pigmeat Markham at the Apollo here in New York. I worked with the Three Stooges in Rhode Island at Providence, and Irene Taylor, who was a marvelous Paul Whiteman singer in Kansas City. It was an interesting time because I learned a lot in vaudeville.
Were you just billed as Bobby Short, or were you billed as, like, that amazing child prodigy, Bobby Short?
Oh, you know I had all of that going for me. It was child prodigy, a miniature king of swing, the wonder boy.
This most sophisticated 10-year-old in America.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Were you, like, the super sophisticated child?
I don't think I was sophisticated. I think that children in show business are necessarily more aware of things than other children are, but I didn't call myself sophisticated. I mean, how could I have done that?
I don't know. Were you wearing tails and tuxes and stuff?
I wore white tails, yes.
Did you love
white
that?
White tails and little white pumps, and I was a cat's meow.
Did you love wearing that?
Well, I did, but you know something? As I said before, work is work. And there were many days when I was doing vaudeville when I wished I were out playing baseball or running with my friends in the streets, you know. There I was in a white tail suit performing 4 times a day, sometimes 5 times a day, and in strange cities with no friends my age. And it became a job of work.
Right. But you still loved, you still knew you were in the right business.
I loved the adulation, but I was totally sensitive, though, to criticism and the rigor involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a show 4 times a day is not easy for a grown up, and for a kid, it's doubly hard, I think.
Did you get a lot of reviews, and did you read them?
I got my reviews, and I read them, and I took them to heart very often, which is something else that's dangerous for a child, you know, to read in stark black and white business terms just how well your performance has gone over. That's not always the most comforting thing in the world. And I read these reviews, and I worried about them. I still worry about reviews. I mean, there are performers who say, oh, I don't care what they write. I don't care what they write. Of course they care what they write. You always care about what's being said about you.
So when you're a child and you're getting reviews, it's like the ultimate report card.
It is indeed. I came from a very, very good scholastic background in Danville with excellent schools, public schools. And I was used to getting report cards, and I was a pretty good student. So to be criticized for my performance was something else to contend with. I also had to contend with the nomenclature of the day regarding performers and the color of their skin and so forth. I mean, every chance that people had in reviewing my act, I was referred to as a mulatto child or a 12-year-old Negro Bobby Breen. I mean, gone are the days. But in those days, it was very, very important to be identified by the color of your skin.
How did you react to that?
Well, my mother instilled in me a tremendous amount of pride, and a skin color never meant very much to me. I got myself into a lot of trouble, I suppose, because it didn't mean that much to me. I felt I was just as good as anybody else. And so I read that, and reading those reviews, did lend me a certain kind of sophistication. I was able to understand that doing their job, they had to point out the good points and the other points of this performer, like breeding a horse. You know, his gait, his color, his parentage, all of that. And so I'm a performer, a working person. People had to know that I was 12 years old, that I had brown skin, and I was a Negro.
That's creepy. I mean, what a really creepy way of compare yourself to a horse like that.
Well, but because I think a horse has to work for you, and we are, you know, this was a business. I was a business vehicle. Do you understand that?
Oh, yeah. No, I understand. Right. And you had promoters and managers.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the salient aspects of myself were
right.
Very, very important to these people. They had to know all about me.
That's a lot to take on as a child.
I think it is. And I think that I was aware of all of that.
Right.
And it was a great deal of, it was very heavy.
Were there performers who kind of took you under their wing and showed you the ropes, helped you out, helped keep your spirits up when you got tired or depressed?
Well, you know, I was a baby. I was 12 or 13 years old, and We'd get into a town, a new town, to do a week in vaudeville. And by the end of the first two or three days, I was the pet of the entire backstage crew, the wardrobe lady, the choreographer, the other performers on the bill. I mean, rarely did I find a performer who was not helpful or was not delighted to see me. Mm-hmm. I remember I worked with the Three Stooges in Providence, Rhode Island, and they were really and truly on my back day and night. They couldn't stand me.
Really?
But I've since learned that back in those days, people in vaudeville came from very, very interesting backgrounds. Many of them had very little education, and they were filled with all kinds of prejudices and a lot of superstition and insecurities. And here was this little smart aleck kid, you know, going out and getting applause. I mean, it wasn't always an easy thing.
Now, you write in one of your memoirs that when you were growing up, you weren't really you had this Protestant upbringing. You weren't exposed to Catholics. You weren't exposed to Jewish people. And you didn't meet any Jews until you went into show business. And then you ended up going to Catholic school, even though you were a Protestant. So that must have been really interesting for you.
It was very funny. I went to Catholic school because the nuns would allow me to take off for a week at a time.
Oh, is that why you went there?
Yes, and public school would not let me do that.
Oh, so this was your equivalent of professional children's school.
Yes, believe me. So short of hiring a private tutor, the Catholic school was the best bet. And so I went there for a year, covering a year and a half's work in public school, and graduated, a year ahead of myself.
What did the nuns think of you being in vaudeville?
Well, I think they had mixed feelings. They were, on the one hand, horrified that this child was out there being exposed to all the sins of the earth. But on the other hand, they were very, very proud to have me in their school. And I was well-behaved, and I was popular enough, I guess. And I made pretty good grades. And so they would always bring me out when visitors came to the school. I was a little, I wasn't even Catholic. They'd bring me out, and I'd play a few pieces, you know.
Bobby Short will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
My dear, I've a feeling you are so near and yet so far. You appear like a radiant star.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Bobby Short about his life and music. And TV critic David Bianculli reports on the best TV shows in the world. He's just back from the Banff Television Festival, where he served on the panel of judges.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer and pianist Bobby Short. He's come to epitomize New York cabaret. Since 1968, he's performed for part of nearly every year at the elegant Café Carlyle. Last week, he announced that he will retire from the Carlyle in 2005, which is the club's 50th anniversary year. Here's Bobby Short singing How Can You Face Me by Andy Razzaf and Fats Waller. They also wrote Honeysuckle Rose and Ain't Misbehavin'. This is from Short's 1986 album of songs by Andy Razzaf.
Love 'em, leave 'em, and deceive 'em seems to be your game. My romance was just your new affair. I was happy, oh so happy, till the awakening came. But now I know I was a fool to care. How can you face me after what I've gone through? All on account of you tearing my heart in two. Have you no conscience? How could you? Why have you grown so cold after the lies you told? No one now seems to be on the level. Since I found that my angel was just the devil, why do I love you? Why did you teach me how? After you broke each vow, how can you face me now?
Now, I know one of your early heroes was Fats Waller. Did you get to meet Fats Waller or Andy Razzaf?
I knew Razzaf quite well because we lived in the same neighborhood in California some years ago. But Waller I just met one evening. I went backstage to see him at the old RKO Palace Theater in Chicago.
How old were you then?
And, oh, I was 12, 13.
Uh-huh.
And I was in vaudeville then. And my managers did one wonderful thing for me. They took me around to meet all the great black vaudevillians. I went to meet Ethel Waters. We just assumed that they'd want to meet a little boy play the piano. And I went backstage to meet Fats Waller and played the piano for some of his musicians. And Fats heard about it and came bustling out and was wonderful. He was delighted to see me and gave me $5 and told jokes and exchanged lots of clever things with me, then took me out for the evening to the Grand Terrace, a nightclub on the South Side. So I loved Fats Waller.
I want to ask you about your father. I know that, you know, he did several things in his lifetime, including working in a coal mine and running an ice cream parlor. And you've said that when you were growing up, he'd kind of visit the family twice a year because at that point he was... you were in Danville, and he was in Kentucky working in a mine. This was during the Depression when work was hard to come by. Had he left the family, too? I mean, was he gone just because of the job, or were there other reasons also?
He was gone because of the job. But, you know, looking at it from my standpoint now, all these years later, the whole thing was just unfortunate. My mother was born in the South, in Kentucky, as most my father, in separate areas of the state. My mother could not bear the thought of segregation or second-class citizenship and used to tell us stories about people being pushed off the sidewalks and this and that and the other, not to mention other more terrible things like lynchings and hangings and so forth. And she intended to raise her children in the North, in Illinois. She thought the thought of a Jim Crow school would have defeated her whole purpose. My father, on the other hand, begged her over and over again to move us all down to Kentucky. And she ruined the marriage by refusing to go.
Oh.
But my hat's off to her.
Now, your father actually died in, was it a coal mining accident?
Well, my father had quit the mines, actually. He was in charge of what they called the bathhouse, an above-the-ground job. And he was doing that. Then for some reason, he was sent down to the mines one day and was gassed. Hospitalized. Lasted 3 or 4 days.
Was there usually gas in the mines? I mean,
there's always gas in the mines, I suppose, and that was a perpetual kind of fear among coal miners.
I see. How old were you?
I was 11 when my father died.
Did that put even more pressure on you to go out and keep performing?
Well, I don't think it did. I didn't look at it that way at all. When my father died, I'd already been out there in the saloons earning money,
mm-hmm,
and helping my mother. My mother, like many mothers in those days, white and black, had to join the workforce. I've learned that many, many white families had the same problems that we had, where mother went out and got a job to feed the children and pay the rent. She became a domestic.
Right. So she was more pressured to get work, but you were already working.
She was pressured. She was pressured to get work.
Yeah.
And I had an older sister who, I think when my father died, had already landed a very, very nice clerical job in Danville. And so she threw in some money. I had two older brothers, and, you know, that's the way it went.
In writing about your father in your books, you said that you really didn't know him very well because he wasn't home most of the time, but you remember he was a great dresser. He had great clothes.
Oh, he was wonderful looking. He wore the most wonderful clothes. And he was a handsome man, handsome devil, and was smart to go with it. Had the most beautiful handwriting and could write speeches in just like that, and was respected for those talents. And I think he must have been a lousy businessman, but he was a very elegant kind of man.
My guest is cabaret singer and pianist Bobby Short. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cabaret singer and pianist Bobby Short. He's performed at the Cafe Carlyle in New York since 1968. I want to pause here for another recording, and I thought this would be a good time to hear something by the Gershwins. And I'm trying to play songs that aren't terribly well known, since I think part of what so many of us really love you for is your ability to find songs we wouldn't necessarily come across. So this is a relatively obscure Gershwin song, which you've recorded and I think probably played a lot. Crazy for You?
Oh, that's a good song.
Oh, I know, yeah. This was the title track of an album of Gershwin songs that you recorded. Did you know Ira Gershwin?
Yes, I knew Ira. I met Ira, spent lots of time with him.
How did you meet?
Well, it's very funny in that I was living in California back in 1919, during the war, and an old friend of theirs saw me at the Hollywood Canteen one night performing for the soldiers. And he said, I'm going to take you out to Ira Gershwin's house tonight. It was Sunday. And we drove out to Ira Gershwin's house, and there sat Ira with a bunch of friends, and I had something to eat and a drink, and I played the piano and sang for him. And that was that.
Well, this is from one of your best-known albums. Bobby Short is Crazy for Gershwin, and this is Crazy for You, also recorded in the 1950s. So here we go, Bobby Short vocals and piano.
Let me give you the lowdown. I'm crazy for you. When it comes to a showdown, I'm crazy for you.
And so though love may not inspire my lingo, till it's making my heart go bango bingo, let me give you the lowdown. I'm crazy for you.
Bobby Short playing the Gershwin's song, Crazy for You. When did you start performing at the Cafe Carlyle?
In 1968.
Would you describe the first night? Do you have any memories of it?
Well, I think I can. You know, to earn a living in this town, at the time I came in 56, was comparatively easy, but it became less and less easy. I arrived in this town as nightlife was beginning to ebb. And big institutions like the Plaza Hotel and the Waldorf and on and on and on were gradually letting go of their entertainment rooms. And I went to work in a room on the mezzanine floor of the Beverly Hotel at 50th and Lexington. And I had a tremendous success there. I think I stayed 19 weeks or something. And I got a very nice foothold in New York with lots of glamorous people around me, Duke and Duchess of Windsor and Dorothy Kilgallen and so forth. And I was always there for a very long time, 19 weeks, 25 weeks, 26 weeks. And the rooms, though, began to thin out. And by 1968, I had gone through some rather hard periods. There were no places in town to work. America was in the grip of rock and roll, mm-hmm. which is not my thing at all.
Right.
And I was having a pretty rough time. And I was working at a place that had very, 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 how can I put it, cooperative and very gentle owners called The Living Room. But the place itself was really kind of dumpy. And I was working there twice a year. And one night, my friend Ahmet Erdogan brought Peter Sharp to hear me there. And Peter Sharp owned the Carlyle Hotel. He just bought it. And so that's the rest of it is history.
Oh, and Ahmet Erdogan was the head of Atlantic Records, which was
yes,
your record label.
Yes, and I'd recorded for Ahmet, yes.
Right. Now, it's, you know, it's interesting. You had developed your reputation in part, you know, playing for, you know, for royalty and for the real glamorous set. Then it got to the point where like, you were the sophisticated person, you were the glamorous one, you were the royalty that people came to see. Do you know what I mean? Like, you come to New York, you have to go hear Bobby Short because you're, because of what you, some, you know, what you came to represent.
It's an interesting turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
If it's at all true.
I think it is. did you ever feel like that it was really ironic that someone like you, who came from such a modest background, a little neighborhood in Danville, Illinois, rose to kind of represent this, like, New York sophistication?
Well, I think about people like Cole Porter from a little town called Peru, or Peru.
Good point. Yeah, good point.
And think of Eleanor Lambert, who was a great fashion icon from Indiana somewhere. Bill Blass from Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Norman Norell, Indiana, small town. It's a kind of a story of America, is it not? I mean, it's the way things work out.
Now, you have dressed in a very sophisticated way over the years. Is there an era that you feel you became a fashion victim?
Fashion victim?
Did you survive the 70s intact in terms
well,
of clothes?
I think, you know, looking back upon America and fashion, there was a time when it was all taken so seriously. This is all to do with rock and roll. But I can recall when a man of a certain age did not dare leave his house wearing a Chesterfield. He had to put on some kind of up-to-date, hoop-de-doo coat. He couldn't just go out dressed in a regular business suit. It just wasn't the thing. Today, thank heaven, there is no fashion as fashion around, and you can dress, you can wear what you want to wear. You can wear an open neck shirt if you feel like it. I hate seeing that in a nightclub or a high restaurant, but it does exist. Or you can be dressed to the nines. It doesn't matter.
Now, I know that when you were born, for some reason, your birth certificate said that you were white, and you didn't really discover that until you started working as a child. Did you ever change it?
Well, that's the funniest thing, because I went to Paris the first time in 1952. And, of course, I required a passport. So I wrote to my mother and said, send me my birth certificate so I can get this passport. Well, it came. Letter perfect, except that it said that I was white. My mother was like this. She crossed out the white part and wrote in her own hand, colored.
Wow.
Well, I knew that the crossed out thing in her own hand was not going to go very far with the authorities. So I wrote to them and said, you made a mistake. They have my real birthday, September 15th. And so the passport came back. It listed me as a Negro. But the birth date was changed to September 5th. And at that point, I thought, to hell with it. I've got to go to France. So I didn't change it. So I had one date on my passport and one date on my driver's license. So who is the real Bobby Short, you know?
Right. What a bureaucratic nightmare.
I love my mother, though, just crossing out white and writing colored. But she was going to correct it herself, you see.
Yeah, yeah. I want to end with another song. And I was thinking of Autumn in New York, which is from a fairly recent album. And Bucky Pizzarelli is featured on guitar on this. And this is a song with a melody by Vernon Duke, who also wrote I Can't Get Started, April in Paris, and a song that you've done a whole lot, I Like the Likes of You. Did you know him?
Yes, I knew Vernon quite well. I met him, oh my goodness, in the 1940s, I guess. And we became quite friendly.
Does it help you as a singer to know well the person who sung that you're singing?
The person who wrote the words and so forth?
Yeah.
I think so. I think that you can't say more respect, but you have a better insight, perhaps. Vernon was meticulous about his songs and the way they were being sung. Not quite so meticulous as Richard Rodgers, perhaps, but meticulous and up to a point, and delighted, as they all were, to have you sing their songs.
Well, Bobby Short, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Pleasure talking with you.
My great pleasure, Terry. I'm a great fan of yours.
Oh, thank you. I'm a much bigger fan of yours.
You're a very sophisticated lady, you know.
It's time to end my lonely holiday and bid the country a hasty farewell. So on this gray and melancholy day, I'll move to a Manhattan hotel. I'll dispense with my rose-colored shadows and prepare for my share of adventures and battles. Here on the 27th floor, looking down at the city I hate and adore. Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York, it brings the thrill of a first nighting. Where glittering crowds and shimmering clouds in canyons of steel are making me feel I'm home. It's autumn in New York. It brings a promise of new love.
Bobby Short from his 1995 album, Songs of New York, recorded live at the Café Carlyle. He now performs at the Carlyle with a small swing band led by Lauren Schoenberg. Short plans to retire from the Carlyle in late 2005. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on some of the best TV shows in the world. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ TV critic David Bianculli was one of five people from five different countries serving as a judge at this year's International TV Festival in Banff, Canada. He's back with this report.
The Banff International TV Festival just celebrated its 25th anniversary. 25 years of collecting, presenting, and honoring the best television programs from around the world. It takes place each year in Western Canada. Down here in the States, many people haven't heard of it and have never gotten the chance to see much of the wonderful TV offered there. Having served several times as a judge, most recently earlier this month for the festival's silver anniversary, I have to say it's a shame that this Olympics of television doesn't somehow make a bigger impact in the United States. By the time the international jurors arrive in Banff, most of the heavy lifting has been done already by the staff. What's waiting for us are about 100 programs in 15 different categories, from animation and children's programs to documentaries, comedies, and dramas. The judges, each coming from a different country and with years of expertise in or around television, watch them all. About 11 days of viewing, about 11 hours a day. If the TV shows were awful, that schedule would be brutal. But the TV, for the most part, is superb. Quite literally, the best TV in the world. Overall, it was a big year for the United Kingdom, which earned awards in more than half the 15 categories. Those winners included plenty of TV programs that ought to be shown here. Wine Gums, a fast-moving 15-minute series of poets performing poetry, is like a rhyming version of Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, just as fast and just as funny. The True Face of War, a bold current affairs documentary, looked at what viewers weren't shown, in England or here, about the war in Iraq. This Little Life is a wrenching, unforgettable TV movie about a mother's prematurely born infant and its struggle for survival. And The Catherine Tate Show, a sketch program in the style of The Tracey Ullman Show, won as Best Comedy Series, a surprise winner, beating out fellow BBC favorite The Office, as well as such slick USA entries as Curb Your Enthusiasm and Frasier. In fact, of all the British winners, only one, to my knowledge, has been shown already in this country. It's the fabulous miniseries State of Play, shown earlier this year on BBC America. It was a 6-part story about journalists cracking a high-level conspiracy case and was the best drama about reporters since All the President's Men. And though this was England, not Washington, D.C., State of Play even had one scene that took place in an underground parking garage. It was a tense meeting between reporter Cal McCaffrey, played by John Sim, and his Ben Bradley-type editor, played by Bill Nighy.
Cameron. Who's leaned on you?
Several people.
When?
Since we opened this story.
So why start being obstructive now?
A, because I can't afford to see my house flash before my eyes. B, you worry me. Your bias in Stephen Collins's favors nudged upwards since you started poking his presumably guilt-ridden wife.
Stephen Collins is being stitched up.
Not without substantial contributions from himself. He was still shagging his researcher when she was murdered. If that's not a story, I don't know what is.
Which he's admitted.
Tell him thank you for confirming the bloody obvious.
You know, he came to me with all that Cramer House stuff. I'm the last person he'd want to confide in, and he came to me because he's got nowhere else to go.
In the miniseries category, State of Play beat out a Canadian drama about illegal immigrants, a British drama about a domestic murder, a Swedish drama about a creepy and troubled little girl, and HBO's Angels in America, which won a separate prize for its high-definition photography. That's a lot of range and a lot of excellence. Programs in other categories made the cut from the Netherlands, Germany, France, Canada, Iran, Russia, Israel, and Japan. Japan, in fact, won the festival's grand prize for an amazingly inspirational family and youth documentary called Children, Full of Life, Learning to Care. It was about a fifth-grade school teacher. So what did the U.S. win? It won for Best Continuing Drama Series, thanks to The Sopranos. It also won in the History and Biography category for an American Experience documentary on Tupperware. In that category, another PBS documentary on Watergate Plus 30 came in a close second. But the Tupperware story impressed the judges more as a clearer and more original program. I was a little surprised by that. But I was also surprised that The Sopranos traveled so well across international cultural lines. Go figure. But the U.S., on balance, didn't travel so well this year. And maybe the way our TV is received internationally is something we should think about at home. The broadcast networks in the States are busy making reality shows, and not one of those was a nominee at Banff. Only 18 of the nominees overall were from the United States. 5 were from PBS, 5 from HBO, and all of the rest, except for NBC's Frasier, were from basic cable. CBS, ABC, Fox, the WB, they didn't get a single nomination. That says something. But for those who care about the status of commercial broadcast television in the U.S., what that says isn't very encouraging.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting the TV premiere of Yves Saint Laurent, 5 Avenue Marceau, part of the Out Loud Film Fest on Sundance Channel, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the difficulties of fitting back into your own family and making ends meet after 16 years in prison. We talk with Elaine Bartlett, the subject of the new book, Life on the Outside, and Jennifer Gonerman, the journalist who wrote the book. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.